One goo, three, yeah!
Mac and goo.
Jaws 3.
Mac and goo.
King of Queens.
Mac and goo.
Meryl Streep.
Mac goo.
Entertainment.
Sup gang, Goo here. Little different format this week. I was able to join the Change My Mind podcast with Nick Fryer and Wesley Sykes to talk with the creators and showrunners of X-Men the Animated Series, Eric and Julia Leewald. X-Men the Animated Series ran from 1992 until 1997 and was one of my favorite shows growing up, and now I look forward to rewatching it again with my son. So, here's Nick Fryer.
We are talking about the art and making of the animated series and the X-Men, the animated series. We're talking to Eric and Julia Leewald, the showrunner and writer. I mean, the masterminds behind this timeless show that, I mean, Eric, Julia, this was when I got Disney Plus, when it came out, the first thing I went back and watched was X-Men, the animated series.
Yeah, hands up. Truth.
Same.
I will tell you, I got kicked off Twitter for 24 hours because when X-Men debuted on Disney Plus in England, because it was such a big hit over here, I was so frantically saying, as people were saying, I love X-Men, I love X-Men, on Disney Plus, I kept retweeting it so quickly they thought I was a bot. But the nice thing is, it really seems to have found an audience again. You know, it's been something people have been very excited for.
Of course. I mean, this is timeless. This is absolutely timeless.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember how many Saturday mornings I spent up watching, X-Men the Animated Series, Bobby's World, you know, having a nice bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch in the morning. That's, I think, a great way to kind of start off most kids' weekends there. So I think for every, 8, 9, 10-year-old or so kind of in that range, this was a hallmark, again, to use that term, in so many kids' childhood. So definitely living out a childhood dream here, I would say.
Oh, that's so kind. Thank you so much.
And I just had a son about 3 months ago, and I am so excited to show this to him as well. So
that makes us even happier to hear that.
Yeah, it's really cool at cons, and you get a 40-year-old guy come up, and he's dragging the 8-year-old kid, and they just said, "Oh yeah, we just watched the whole thing together," and just going from one generation to the next one, and it makes me remember stuff I watched with my dad when I was a kid, and just how great that experience is when you can share the excitement about something. It's great.
Now, you guys had another book that you published a few years ago, and this was, I believe it was previously on X-Men, The Making of an Animated Series, correct?
We're grabbing that copy right now, just to make sure.
Yeah, and the difference there was, we started this one about five years ago, and that's
previously
some
on
nice
X-Men.
Original artwork by Will Minio, who did the show, the cover of it. And at the time, I know this sounds weird, but Marvel and everybody had just forgotten about the show. The rights were split between Marvel and Fox and maybe a couple other places, and they just didn't even want to return our phone calls. So we went ahead and interviewed everybody that worked on the show and did this book anyway with a really tiny publisher and without Marvel's blessing and no color artwork. Limited illustrations. But it's a really dense 450-page, 200,000-word history of the whole thing from my point of view. And so it was very satisfying.
And it kind of got us a way in to go to cons,
yeah,
and festivals.
And as soon as it came out in the fall of 17, we would get con requests, and it would be something to focus on. It would be something for us to sign, because we're not artists.
And we're not voiceover.
And so that was a start. And then a couple of years ago, once Marvel and Fox were getting back together and we were hoping to be able to see the show again, because the show wasn't even on the air anywhere, we got an email from a major guy at Marvel, and we thought, oh damn, they're coming after us for doing the book without their permission.
Yeah.
And overstepping our bounds a little bit, because some of the gray area stuff that we used in the book. And he said, no, we read it, and all the staff loved it here. And they said, now that the rights are together, the first thing on our list to do, what's the first thing to do, is let's do a book on X-Men the Animated Series as an art book, and do it with a big publisher that's used to doing art books. And so it was his idea.
Sven Larson
is a great guy, who happened to have his first job at age 25, serious job, working for Marvel at the time that we were doing the show. So now, 27 years later, he gets the opportunity to go to his bosses and say, the best thing we know to do is a book on this show that I loved back when I was there. So that's it. He started it, and we ran with it. And but that's so the first book got us the second book.
Speaking of previously on, that's something that led off so many X-Men episodes. Yeah. And the fact that you gave children so much faith that they would be able to follow these two-part, three-part, four-part stories is something that I don't think any other animated show would do.
That was a big deal and a big, I'm not going to say bone of contention, because credit to the president of Fox Kids, Margaret Lesh, mm-hmm. who was the person who had the position and the vision to make the show happen, because she had been working at Marvel for a number of years and couldn't give away the X-Men as much as she tried. Mm-hmm. When she was in charge at Fox Kids, it was like, okay, we're making this show and we're going to make Batman the animated series. She had a list of things she wanted to get done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The challenge was Will Mineo and Larry Houston on the art side, production side, are big comic book fans themselves. And most comic books play out over the course of two or three or however many volumes. You read and you go, oh, okay, you got to wait for the next issue. And feeling that that kind of storytelling is what X-Men is grounded in.
Yeah, we were frustrated, a number of us, on the art side, on the writing side. We've been working in the business 5-10 years, all of us. And we'd all come close, or we'd all thought, well, this show could be pretty good. And then certain restrictions were thrown to us about, oh, it's just for kids, so you got to talk down to them. Or no, they can't be connected stories. And no, you can't do this, can't do that. And we ended up, okay, fine, we got to pay our bills. So we'll write or draw the best we can. But this isn't as good as it could be. And this was this one little opening, this one gap in the control of people that were thinking that way, where Fox was just starting out as a really small network, trying to get some attention, and they wanted to be different. And so all of us on the creative side just pushed and said, we want connected stories. We want big Marvel spectaculars. We want all these intense adult characters. And the executives at Fox, to their credit, kept on saying yes, 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 even when the people they were dealing with and who were putting money up or were, you know, putting ads up, were going crazy. What is this stuff you're trying? So they stuck with it. They said, yes, you can try this. And Margaret, I mean, part of the problem with having connected stories with old hand-drawn animation is it takes 4 months overseas for them to draw it and film it. And if it comes back a week before airtime and it's not right, you've just screwed up as episode 3 out of a 5-parter, and you can't show the rest.
That's a whole month of shows right there.
Yeah. So you've that's one reason that they hesitate doing connected series, serial storytelling. And in fact, we were told after the first season, no, you can't do it. So we said, well, but can we do 2-parters and 3-parters and 4-parters? We kept on trying to get back to it because we just think the writing is better when it's a longer story.
I want to give one of the show's editors, a woman named Sharon Janis, because she was the one who crafted those previously on X-Men little intros to the shows. And one of the reasons that got sold to the folks in charge of the money was the realization, oh, if there's someone who's coming up with 30 seconds to a minute of previously on animation snipping together from other episodes, that's less that we have to pay for new. So, oh my God. You know, the funny things that make things happen, but that is one of the reasons that got to happen for us.
And it may not confuse the children. They just were sure that having this many characters and having multi-part stories, kids just, what is this? I don't understand. You know, I didn't see the first part. And so they don't get how obsessive and how smart kids are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You know, you mentioned the 2-part series, multiple part series. You come out of the gates doing a couple of those, you know, doing the Magneto's debut, and you have the Sentinel story as well. So, you know, were you trying to build up the worlds as quickly as possible, or what was kind of the mindset behind that, you know, having so many multiple part episodes so early?
Knowing that we're going back to 1992, there was no internet. There was no way to research anything. No one had computers, you know, in their phones. No one. It was very primitive. And remembering that and realizing that X-Men was huge in the world of comic books. But as much as we might not like to admit it, in the 1990s, the comic books were themselves a corner of certain fan interest.
Pop culture. And we were warned that maybe 85 to 90% of the people that turned the show on wouldn't know who the X-Men were. They'd turn on they watched television, but they weren't comic book people yet, especially the younger kids. And so the question about multiple parts, that first season, we really didn't know that there'd be any more seasons.
We didn't. 13 episodes.
But Mark Edens and I, who laid out the first season, those stories, our first responsibility was in those 13 to set up the world and introduce as many of the basic characters. There's so many hundreds of characters in the X-Men universe after 30 years. So we wanted to introduce the main people and get the audience to know and love and fall in love with the core main characters. That was our key. We didn't, you know, if people were getting mad at us, you know, Marvel people or fans or whatever, saying, oh, you haven't introduced this guy yet. Or, you know, we haven't met Mr. Sinister. Or we haven't met this guy. We just were trying to lay the basic world down in 13 and get that set. And then starting the second season, we were able to go off and meet all sorts of new people and get more personal stories. But there was a lot of pipe laying in the first 13.
A lot of introducing to the audience in general.
And
just
so,
to get
so
them
all
in the
we
world.
Cared about was it started with the Sentinels being a problem for the mutants, and it ended in episode 13 with that resolved. And anything in between, we were just trying to, okay, what can we do to make people get to know Rogue better or get to know Jubilee better in these 13 episodes while they're entertained and while things are blowing up everywhere?
We're talking with Eric and Julia Leewald, the creators and showrunners of X-Men, the animated series. And with the X-Men, they have a backbone in dealing with prejudice. How did you try and incorporate that without, I don't know, maybe bashing it over the audience's head or being too heavy on them? Because, you know, it might be tough, you know, dealing with a 5 or 6 year old with this type of a topic.
Give you and Mark Edens credit for when you got the call to come up with 13 stories, and that might be the only 13 you get to tell with X-Men, but come up with 13 stories. There was a lot of pushback against you and Mark about how you were choosing to introduce the mutants to the world in general. And a lot of folks were pushing for get our mutants to fight other mutants right out of the gate. So it's mutant on mutant, and then it becomes kind of a fight of the week sort of thing. And it's interesting, it can be fun, but you guys went a different route. You chose.
Yeah. We wanted the prejudice thing came kind of naturally, but all the adult themes in it, and part of it is we've always thought if we write for ourselves as adults, that the kids will love it too. I mean, I think the old Warner Brothers shorts did that, you know, Rocky and Bullwinkle. There's a whole history of stuff that's written supposedly for children, but the adults that do it write it to delight themselves. And so that was our attitude this time. We said, okay, the shackles are off. We're going to be allowed to do this. Let's really do this. And what we discovered was all these adult emotions, like the love triangles and the family dramas and things that really made the show more intense, where we couldn't show a certain amount of violence, so we had a lot of interpersonal emotional violence. Those things, even if a 5-year-old didn't get that Wolverine and Scott were both fighting over the same woman, you know, to have sex with her, that isn't in their head. Romance isn't in their head, but they're used to, you know, having maybe losing a friendship or what, you know, when Morph was killed, they might not understand death, but they understand loss and, oh, they're never going to see their friend again. The underlying emotions for the little kids connected in some way with all the adult problems that the people were having there. And we get all these notes, you know, from people saying, stop, you know, putting all this adult stuff in, this stuff for kids. And I say, you guys just don't understand. They may not get it till they're older, exactly what was going on or exactly why all these people were mad at each other. But they understand friendship and being ostracized or being made part of a club or being pushed out of the club or being disappointed in a friend. They understand all these things on a real basic level. And so making the adult stories made the adults be able to watch it. And the teens love it because it was, you know, more adult than the other shows on. And still, we still had huge, you know, 2 to 5 year old audience. I think they like the fast pace and the colors.
Yeah.
but they also, I think they got the underlying emotions.
But absolutely, the fact that the initial stories involved the fact that humans were, there were a lot of humans who were shunned mutants in general because they didn't understand or know the mutants. And that's how you ended up with the Sentinels to control this population that this part of the population didn't like. And I don't think there's a kid in America who doesn't at some point feel other or different. And boy, when you hit puberty, whoo, off the charts right there. But the idea that what you are can be viewed by other people as being something awful or scary or nasty, and you have to be, you know, shunned and ostracized. I think that was sort of the what became the backbone of the X-Men.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the superpowers are fun. It's like, you know, the shootouts in a Western or something. But the, great Westerns are about the characters, and the shootouts happen. But that's not what, you know, you do that because you need it for the genre. But the best stuff is always about the characters.
And I think that starting out with the Sentinels and then going to Magneto after that is absolutely brilliant, because by the time you get to that third episode or that fourth episode where Magneto is introduced, he's not the bad guy. I mean, he technically is, but he's not.
Right. That was really intentional. We didn't want, we wanted, I mean, think how all the great moments in the show and then in the future movies where you get this weird situation where Xavier and Magneto are lifelong best friends but adversaries. And you're right, if you start out with Magneto being a unredeemable villain slaughtering someone, then you can't set that up. You set up that the world's against both of them and they just have different answers for it. Then you can have this relationship go throughout all the stories.
They, each of them are committed to their take on how the world is handling this. And each of them is right in his own way. And but and yet that they are.
And it kind of broke my heart when Magneto got his chance with the asteroid. Asteroid M, he got his chance to have his, you know, go back to Africa situation, and it was all beautifully set up, and he did it all right, and then somebody betrays him. Somebody more ambitious betrays him.
Previously on Mac and Goo. Goo joined the Change My Mind podcast with Nick Fryer and Wesley Sykes, and we are talking with the creators and showrunners of X-Men the Animated Series, Eric and Julia Leewald.
So is there a particular storyline, particular episode that you look back over the course of the series that you feel like is best representative of the show, or something that you know, you're most proud of?
You want to go first? I mean, I can, but go ahead.
If we're talking about just the show, and you know, I'm going to call. Well, what's interesting? Sorry, there's so many in my head right now because we've been having.
I know. I'm just narrowing it down. It's got to be tough.
I often call out the episode Beauty and the Beast, just because that was based on a premise that I'd come up with and brilliantly written by writer Stephanie Matheson. But the idea that my favorite character, the the romantic, brilliant, big blue guy, you know, finally who is above that kind of stuff, finally has a chance at genuine happiness, and it's reciprocated. But the ugly world around them won't let them be happy. And that, what decade are we in? And that's still a thing that can resonate, and it still breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. And boy, howdy, if anyone ever chooses to revisit the episode, wouldn't that be fun to see 22 years later where Carly is, you know, yeah, and where Hank is, and if they can find each other now, you know, okay, there you go. You asked. That's my answer.
Yeah. I love it. Thank you.
Yeah. A couple of answers. The hardest, I think the one I'm most proud of as far as the craft of the storytelling was the five-part Phoenix saga. Just, I got to do that with my two college buddies alone with nobody else involved. Usually if there's a four or five-parter, there'd be half a dozen writers involved. It was just the three of us simplifying that story and making it work at 108 minutes or whatever, 110, whatever it comes out to. That was a real craft challenge. And I'm thinking the fact it came out smoothly and people really enjoyed it and got it from the complex thing that the comics were. Comics was very involved, like 10, 14 issues of it.
Right.
That was hard. That was a challenge. But the story that, you know, my job supervising the writing, the hardest part was coming up with the kernel of the story that, oh, I choose this one rather than 800 other stories. And sometimes you come up with an okay story, or someone say, well, they did this all right in the books. Do you want to try it? Do you want to try something like it? You know, they fall in love, or, you know, they meet their father, or, you know, come up with whatever your long list of emotionally based story ideas. And the one that that came to me out of the whole 5 years, I think that what it came to me is, oh, this is absolutely right for the show. This is it. This is the best one I've come up with in a couple of years, was One Man's Worth. Which what basically the whole idea of the show was to show why the X-Men exist. Because at all it was if someone had gone back and killed Xavier, there's never been any X-Men, what would that do to the world? Of course, it's a ripoff from a Star Trek episode and from It's a Wonderful Life, but it fits so beautifully with the X-Men and with Charles that was the story I think I was most proud of coming up with.
And that is a two-parter for folks who are following along at home. that also has one of those moments, watching it again, going, oh my God, how it remains painfully relevant, where, and it breaks my heart, because in alternate Horrorville, alternate awfulness, where Xavier didn't exist, Wolverine and Storm found each other and found true love and are married and they have wedding bands. And that's the only time Wolverine is happy in the whole freaking show. And it just kills me. But when they travel and with Bishop and they end up in a small dumpy dive somewhere, and the innkeeper, well, we don't serve those kind here. And Storm just stunned. Wait, skin color prejudice? That's so pathetic, it's almost quaint. To which Wolverine goes, it ain't quaint. Apologize to the lady. But you go, oh my God. You know, that was in 1994, which was not that many years removed from the 1960s, where there were horrible things like that kind of segregation of people in restaurants and movie theaters. And here we are now 20 odd years later, and there's still
issues.
Yeah, still issues. So there you go.
Well, I think 94 is also what the 90 the LA riots that were going on there, right? Oh. So I think timely, even in the moment. But you know, you touched on Apocalypse there, or I'm sorry, Dark Phoenix a little bit, and I'm just curious because we've seen that adapted in so many different ways. You know, in your estimation, why do you feel like it was able to work? Because I think that was so critically acclaimed from the animated series. You know, how were you able to make that such an effective story?
I think just there's like a couple advantages. One of them was I tend to think there's a reviewer, a great reviewer, Brian Lowry, who's like the best TV reviewer in my lifetime. He used to do it for Variety and LA Times, and he believes that comic books work better in animation than in live action. That there's certain things that are a little bit larger than life or a little hard to buy if it's a guy in a spandex suit rather than something drawn. Mm-hmm. And so I think maybe the stories, I'm not claiming we had any specific brilliant insight into it, but so maybe that was one advantage we had in that this space opera is happening with Phoenix and Dark Phoenix, and that might be easier to buy with drawings rather than people. I don't know. But also they changed a lot for the movies and for the last one, Dark Phoenix. What I'd heard was they'd used some of the Dark Phoenix material in previous movies so that they had to like throw out half of the story and come up with a new story.
I can help you out there. So in Captain Marvel, they used the entire ending that was going to be in Dark Phoenix. Right. So they had to scrap the entire like third act.
I'll say too that by the time X-Men, the animated series, got to Phoenix and Dark Phoenix, audiences had gotten to sort of spend time and breathe over a couple of years, learning these characters, getting to know them. You know, starting to, oh, I like that one, or that one, that's my favorite, or you know, playing in the playground, saying, no, I'm Storm, or the whole audience, the whole world was getting to know these characters. And then when you got the chance to do those episodes, it wasn't a 22 minute episode. It was a series of episodes for the Phoenix. And then there was breather. And then there was, so you had more time to have had that experience and then come into it And then you went into Dark Phoenix. So there was room for it all to breathe for the audience, I think.
You guys were able to cross over many Marvel heroes throughout the X-Men series. First off, who was your favorite to introduce to this audience? And also, would it be you guys asking the studio to bring someone in? Or would they say to you, hey, can you introduce Captain America?
Well, again, okay, you're right. Captain America, that's that kind of character. On the X-Men side of things, I loved the introduction of Nightcrawler. I thought, I still can't believe we got away with that on a kid's show. And I'm not sure anyone would allow you to do that today, considering that was all about an examination of religion. we got to do that? What? You know, and it wasn't proselytizing. It wasn't saying you have to accept this or you have to turn away from it. But it was such a candid conversation about that with a character who looks satanic and is in that. Wow.
Yeah. And again, and that was just, we were just trying to think, okay, we want to introduce Nightcrawler. He's a major character. He's an X-Men in a bunch of the books. And it always comes back to character. Who's going to be the most affected by meeting this guy, assuming he's a stranger to the X-Men? And Wolverine seems to be the one that probably has the most spiritual baggage, you know, more than the rest of the X-Men put together.
He's the oldest. He's been around the longest.
So he's the one that should get thrown in with this guy. If it was Jubilee, what would she have to kind of connect with? You know, she hasn't had lost her faith four times in her life the way Wolverine has. So that was, the kernel of the story was we meet Nightcrawler and Wolverine has a crisis of faith over it. And that was, you know, the log line to get the thing done. That was probably my favorite. You know, I thought the same writer that did both of the Nightcrawlers, our friend Len Yulee, also did the Iceman episode.
Oh, yeah, there you go, Iceman.
And so those are the only three he wrote, but he really had a feeling for those characters. The Captain America thing was cool because that was, as you're talking about, at the beginning, we would be talking to Marvel somewhat about who they liked, but they were basically leaving us alone. It wasn't until the third season when they suggested the Phoenix Sagas that they were really, you know, suggesting we would be picking out of the ones we would find. The Captain America one, so many other characters we weren't allowed to use legally, which is a weird, stupid thing. That they had these barriers. Some of us were rights issues. Who knows?
Yeah.
But later, when in other shows we worked on, we said, well, let's bring in these three or four Marvel characters. And no, we're saving them for their own shows.
That never happened.
Yeah. As if overlap would be a problem.
Yeah.
You know. But in this case, the lawyers had to go through and get special permission to get to use him on that one episode.
Bringing Captain America.
I was talking to Len Wein and I said, we've got, you know, can you do one more episode before we're done with the series? And he said, well, what I always wanted to do would be Captain America and Wolverine getting together.
And Len Wein is the co-creator of Wolverine and so many of the
Storm,
characters.
And
it's like, know, he's Len Wein, you know, so, if he wants to do Captain America.
So we asked, Fox asked, and it took, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks, but we got the legal permission, because otherwise the lawyers just would have said, no, you can't use him next, you know, cut him. You know, so
for the episode Old Soldiers, Len Wein got to write for Wolverine and Captain America. And I think that's a very affecting episode too.
Yeah.
Can you guys clear something up on the topic of Wolverine? I feel like Wolverine was recently kind of making his rounds on Twitter. There was a big debate going on with a bunch of comic book fans about his height. And I think over the years, people have gotten used to Hugh Jackman, who I think we can all agree have done such a great job, but he can't help the fact that he's a tall guy, right? So I think what this book actually really does a great job of, what I really enjoy is, like, in the early first few pages of it, you kind of get the back of the baseball card statistics of all the different X-Men. And I think that kind of clears it up, because he looks like, I don't know if I don't have the number in front of me, I want to say 5'2".
We've heard 5'3", but he was short, and all the runt stuff was important, and all the, you know, push pushed around stuff. I mean, the shorter guy with the chip on his shoulder.
You like picking on people smaller than you. Well, I'm smaller than you. Try picking on me.
Yeah. It was very important to the character. And there, yeah, if Hugh Jackman weren't such a good actor and weren't so good for the role, it might have been a little bit more annoying. But they were able to get to his character without worrying about his size.
Do you think the studio misread 5'6" and got 6'5" instead?
Like I said, I thought it was 5'3", so
it looks like 5'3" in the book right here. Yeah, 5'3".
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Now it seems like every day, every week, there's a new article written, a new video made about how the MCU is going to introduce the X-Men, and everyone seems to just be speculating. I'm not asking you guys to tell us anything, you know, concrete, but you've found a way to introduce the X-Men into our lives once. Do you have any ideas for how they should do this?
Can we say, well, if Marvel were to call us, we would be thrilled to share some ideas with them, because the truth is no one has. Yeah. We'll tell you, no one has reached out to us.
I'm sure it's such an immensely huge thing now. There's so many billions of dollars and so many hundreds or thousands of people that are focused on this now. It's so odd to us because this was like a little garage band to us. We were just had this stuff dumped in our lap and said, make a show. We'll let you know if it's successful or not. No real oversight, no micromanaging. It was just the show that we and the artists wanted to slap together, and it got slapped together. It's a whole whole nother world now.
Slapped together with love.
It's weird that I know that's a challenge. I mean, they've set up this thing, unprecedented all these different superheroes that all are successful, and they've managed to give them, you know, different tones and different focuses. And I'm continually in awe in this juggernaut that they've set up. I guess I can't use that word because it's character. I don't know. That seems over. I don't know what Kevin Feige. You know, I don't know how he sleeps at night trying to keep all these balls in the air. But for the X-Men, when people ask me that about integrating them in the MCU, I always had the reverse problem. There were too many X-Men and too many villains already in the X universe, and too many connected characters. I found myself cutting half of them out and having stories about three of the X-Men just to keep sane and to not have to try to service all of them at once in a 22-minute episode. And that, and so the idea of all of the X-Men and all of their villains and all of their support crew then interacting with all of the Avengers and all of the Thors and all of, it's crazy making to me. I don't even want to try to go there.
Oh yes, he does.
Oh yes. Although a quick note for Goof with the Thor shirt. Just so you know, the two guys that did most of the writing for me, Mark and Michael Edens, who are friends of mine from college, and I, we had a pitch. Got paid a little for it. To when it was Avi Arad and Stan Lee doing the Marvel stuff, a couple of years after X-Men, to do a Thor show. And really? We did, and we wrote up like a 50-page Bible.
That's right.
And it was like kind of dead serious, mythological intensity, you know, slaying frost giants kind of stuff. And they didn't care for it, so they passed, and it never happened. We did the research. It would have been fun.
Yeah.
It would have been nasty, dark Thor stuff.
Wow. Well, Eric and Julia, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Of course, everybody can find them on Twitter at XMenTAS. Oh, yes, please. We want to plug you the book and everything.
And we're on Twitter at XMenTAS, which is for the animated series. We are on Instagram, and we're trying to get better there. XMenTAS, and please find us on Facebook. I'm on Twitter way too much, just me trying to get the word out. But XMenTAS, please find us.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, and we have a webpage that we need to update a little more often, but we are there at XMenTAS.com for that as well.
And of course, the book X-Men: The Art and Making of the Animated Series can be found on Amazon. Where else can it be found?
All over the place. Walmart online, Target online, your local bookstore.
Yeah, let me get a pitch in here for local bookstores. We just did a signing at Dark Delicacies over in Burbank, and for books there, for them to have there in their store. Local bookstores are just getting hammered these days. And if you can, consider ordering through your local bookstore, whether it's a bookstore or a comic book store. We encourage that this year.
Yeah, because they tend to be ordering this new book, which they get. The other book was a little too dry for some of them, or just, you know, it didn't have Marvel's backing. So, but I think a lot of bookstores are aware of this. And I think down the line, since it's Disney Marvel, it'll probably end up at, you know, Disney theme park
gift
shops.
So.
But for right now, go to your local bookstore, and they should have them in by now.